Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Geek Warning, brought to you by the Escape Collective. I'm James Huang, and I'm once again here in our virtual studio with our usual panel of geeks. Joining me from Sydney, Australia is Escape Collective's senior technical editor, Dave Rome, in Sydney, Australia. Hi, Dave.
Howdy.
And we also have our other tech editor up in Ireland, Ronan McLaughlin. Hi, Ronan.
Hello.
We've got a little bit of a short timeline here for you, because apparently you have to go get on a plane to go do something fun.
Yeah.
Can we tell people what that fun thing is?
I suppose we probably can. No reason why not, I guess. I'm going to meet Johnny Long. After I meet Johnny Long, I'm going driving a Formula One car, but that won't be as fun as meeting Johnny Long.
Perfect. How are those garage cabinets coming along?
I have 5 built now, so another 3 or 4 to go.
That's pretty good.
I found myself some worktops yesterday. I got 8 meters of worktop for £60, I think, £70. Should have been £200 for 4 meters.
Wow. You know what that sounds like to me?
Bargain.
Sounds like 8 meters of clutter.
I'm probably not going to use it all, but it was like such a good day that I just had to take it. may end up needing a new tool, a new saw to cut through it. Not sure what I have is up to this, but we'll see.
I'm sure you will be able to tackle that problem when it comes up. Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, Dave, I have a slightly different variation on my usual question for you. What is next on your list of tools to buy?
Next on the list of tools to buy? I feel like I'm very reactive to the world of tools.
Oh, interesting. I wasn't sure if this was like a pre-planned sort of thing or just kind of more spur of the moment.
No, I mean, I still would like to get another disc brake facing, disc brake tab facing tool. That's been on the list for a while. I mean, I've got the Park tool and it does the job, but I still would very much like to actually own one of the tools, a VAR or a Cyclist, that does both tabs simultaneously. So that's been something that I've been actually. Every few months I get inspired and try to buy one and then realize just how hard it is to actually get one of those sent to Australia.
And how expensive they are.
And yeah, so one day.
Perhaps maybe. Next time I fly to meet you, Dave, and I could bring one from here.
Yes, that would be very good. Yeah, it's funny. I have actually ordered the VAR like 3 times through 3 individual people and then ended up like either canceling or them not being able to get it for me. So yeah. We'll get there eventually. It's the elusive tool.
Of the VAR and the Cyclist, Dave, do you have a preference as to which one you would probably get?
Yeah, I think they both have their limitations. I think the Cyclist has limitations in the way it mounts the bike with the axle, and the VAR has limitations in the fact that they don't respond to emails. and also, some people have had them where they're not actually, the tool itself is not perfectly straight, and they've had to use like a washer to make the tool straight or to make the cutters level. So I think that's kind of an issue. Neither are absolutely perfect, but I think between the two, probably the Cyclist.
Intriguing. All right. Well, looking outside of that, it has been definitely a very busy week in the world of bike tech. We've got a long list of things to talk about today. So we've got a new bike from legendary US brand Moots. That's a little bit of a head scratcher. We've got some new aero wheels from DT Swiss and Fulcrum. Some promising and maybe not so promising tire news, and also some promising and not so promising news about a couple of e-bike brands. We're also going to chat about Ashton Lambie's recent adventure with a little bit of a trailside frame repair. I've also got some thoughts on how to stay safe while riding on the road, and we'll finish up with a kind of a perplexing little PSA, maybe not so perplexing, but a little unusual little PSA on charging your Shimano Di2 electronic drivetrain. So, as I said, it is a long list, so maybe let's just go ahead and dive right in. Plus, Ronan needs to go to bed. First up, anyway, is this new Moots. So as most of you listening to this podcast probably already know, so Moots is a Colorado brand that's built its entire identity on handcrafted titanium bikes. And this new Express is neither of those things. It's a carbon fiber E gravel bike. It's molded in Asia. Just the fact that it's molded in Asia in and of itself isn't that big of a deal. It's also outfitted with a Shimano EP801 mid-drive e-assist motor. It's got a Shimano e-bike specific 1x11 drivetrain, kind of based on the XT Di2 system. It's got Shimano GRX carbon wheels, a bunch of carbon fiber finishing kit that comes from Moot's own in-house brand, Mod, M-O-D. There's a battery hidden inside the down tube that Moot says will power this thing well past 100 miles. That is a quote, which is the equivalent of 161K. And the system has been tuned to, quote, feel like a Moot, unquote, whatever that means. So claimed weight is pretty impressive, actually, for an e-bike of any sort. It's only 15 kilos, 33 pounds. Retail price is an even 10K US, and sorry, it's only US only for now. And it looks like it'll actually be a pretty good e-gravel bike. The only issue I have with this thing, however, is that I'm not really sure this is a Moot in the traditional sense of the word.
It's not. Yeah, as you say, it looks like a fantastic bike. It looks like they've done their research and figured out what that market needs and what a customer looking to buy an e-gravel bike probably wants out of such a bike. And it looks like they've nailed it. I just don't think it has the right brand on the down tube. I think they've misstepped here. And this is exactly where you would create a sister brand or a sibling brand to launch the product with and sell it off the back of Moot. Say, you know, designed by the team of Moots, or, you know, engineered and designed in Steamboat Springs, the house of Moots, or something like that. But don't, yeah, I don't know. It's just Moots is such an iconic titanium American made brand that this just feels so weirdly misplaced within that name.
I mean, maybe I'm too close to this and, you know, maybe I've had Moots on too high a pedestal for too much of my life or something, but I mean, this almost kind of feels like sacrilege to me. Like, so again, like I said, the fact that it's the fact that any frame is made in Asia, I don't think is an inherently bad thing. There's tons and tons of carbon fiber frames in particular made in Asia that they're awesome. Nothing wrong with that. But the fact that this is neither titanium nor made in Steamboat Springs automatically, to me, discounts it from being a Moots.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's worth stating, like, Moots has had some change of heads lately. Like, it's, you know, they were acquired in, I believe it was 2019, by a private owner. And yeah, I mean, it's sole ownership now. And I guess he gets to call the shops. No, not sole ownership.
No, actually, from what I hear, actually, there has been another change of hands. So the sole owner, Brent Whittingham, mm-hmm. I think he lives in Little Rock, Arkansas, somewhere around there. Or maybe
he moved to Colorado. Yeah, he was in Arkansas, I think.
Okay, yeah. Well, yeah. He, from what I've been told, he sold all but 20% of the company to a group of investors in Texas last year. So basically, at the height of the COVID-fueled bike boom. So
that's interesting.
My guess is I would presume he made a decent little paycheck off of that thing. But I mean, fine. You invest in something, you can't blame someone for wanting a return on that investment or turning it around and, you know, getting a payback or whatever at some point. But whereas Brent was very, at least publicly, I guess, blunt about his position on, you know, where he thought Moot should go in terms of growth. And he said very clearly that he was totally fine with slow and steady, kind of like the slow burn, nice little steady simmer.
Yeah. I mean, Forbes published an article with an interview with him stating that, and that he wants to keep the brand as its iconic titanium American made brand.
Yeah. And while there have been some changes in the brand in the last few years, there's really nothing crazy. Mm-hmm. I would say there's never been any red flags raised in the last few years.
Yeah.
This is a big red flag for me, however. I definitely agree, Dave, that this feels like the sort of thing that should have been done under some sort of sister brand. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can think of few brands that have as much brand equity built up over that long of a legacy that could potentially damage that brand equity in such a short period of time by having something like this. And again, the bike itself seems like it's going to be a very good gravel bike, but yeah. I do find it telling how everything about Moots is about where it's made, what it's made from, you know, the craftsmanship, the years of experience, all that stuff. And from what I gather, seemingly nothing, none of that really applies to this thing. And I also found it very telling how in the press release, the media pack that we got on this thing, there is basically zero mention of anything about the frame. So there's actually a section called frame features, and it doesn't talk about the carbon fiber it's made of or the design process or why it's shaped the way it is or anything like that. It talks about like number of bottle mounts and front and rear fender mounts and that sort of thing. It pains me to say this, but this thing just comes off as being so generic, and seeing that Moots logo in the down tube just hurts me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, totally agree. And I guess, like, you know, there's countless examples of brands, iconic prestige brands that have created sibling brands, offshoot brands to save the iconic label. And the one like top of mind for me, because it's Tools, is Snap-on in the US, a public listed company. And for them, they have Bluepoint Tools, which is their offshoot brand of Asian source tools. So tools that they're not manufacturing themselves, but they're happy to put their brand on. They're happy to supply their lifetime warranty on, and it's what their truck drivers, their salespeople sell as an alternative to the Snap-on brand. So Snap-on remains as the prestige brand. Pretty much everything in that lineup is made in America, or at least done to their own designs and standards. And then, the Bluepoint brand is the stuff that isn't, basically, that fills the gap, that hits a lower price point. That's an example of branding done right, because the Snap-on brand remains as valuable as it always was while they're still selling product that isn't necessarily Snap-on.
That's an example of that, but is this Moots project an example of, if I remember right, something you discussed with Rob English after the MADE show, was there are more brands within the cycling space now getting into spaces where typically they haven't been previously. And I think the example you used there was custom frame builders now moving into like stock frames and that.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess there may be a little bit of a parallel there, but the difference to me with a lot of custom brands moving into stock offerings is that by and large, if they are not the ones actually still doing the building, they at least, the design of the frame is still as identical to what they have done before custom. Yeah. And usually the people making those frames are, they're contractors that are usually often very like physically close to where they are. And they're often by other well-known builders who maybe just have production capacity.
And if not, if they are outsourcing to say Taiwan, like Sklarbikes, they're at least using their expertise and their experience in the metal that they have the expertise in to produce bikes that they've prototyped themselves and have, you know, tested the custom made version themselves and have now given it to other skilled hands to reproduce. I feel like what's happening here with Moots is not at all that. This is not a titanium bike. This is not an analog bike. You know, this is wholly new and wholly outside of Moots' wheelhouse.
I mean, I do think that Moots probably did need to introduce an e-bike at some point. Yeah, I mean, the reality is their demographic for their customer base is probably on average a fair bit older than what it is for the bike industry at large, which is already probably older than average, I'm guessing. And as nice as Moots bikes are, I could certainly see how you wouldn't want to be some, you know, middle 50s, 60s or whatever Moots owner who is kind of finding themselves unable to really fully enjoy the bike that they bought however many years ago. So they want to find an e-bike and they would love to stick with Moots. And, you know, my issue is that, you know, I'm not sure why this isn't a titanium e-bike instead of a carbon fiber one. It just doesn't feel right.
Yeah, I mean, in Moose's defense, titanium e-bikes, they probably looked into it and they're pretty ugly. Like, you've got pretty big limitations on how you can integrate. Like, yes, you can use 3D printing to make like the motor mounts and that type of thing, but you still have to consider where the battery goes. And with titanium tubes, that's no easy feat.
It would have been quite a lot heavier too, for sure.
Yeah, it would have been heavier. I get that it doesn't make a lot of sense there, but it just returns to the idea that like, I'm fine with this bike existing. I just think Moots should remain an American-made titanium brand as it always has been, and they can sell off that history in other ways than what they're doing here.
I mean, at this point, you know, there's no there's no putting the genie back in the bottle, so to speak. This bike is out. Moots can't move it away from, like, you know, they can't remove their label from the down tube.
Nope.
These bikes have already been produced, from what I understand. There's not very many of them, from what I hear. So I guess it remains to be seen how this goes and what sort of effect this may or may not have on the brand. To be very clear,
what it means for future models.
Yeah, totally. And what it means for Moots in general, like, what is Moots going to be as a brand? So, you know, to be very, very clear, like, the article that's out right now on Escape Collective, it certainly is not terribly kind to this decision by Moots. But, you know, I certainly want to let everyone know that I certainly derived no joy in writing this article. Moots is a brand that's certainly very near and dear to my heart. You know, grew up absolutely lusting and, you know, adoring the brand growing up, looking at them in magazines and that sort of thing. And it just hurts me to see this happening, and I hope I'm wrong. But I don't think I am. So we'll see.
Yeah.
All right. Well, in less controversial news, we got a couple of, well, I guess a bunch of new road wheels from
things to make it controversial.
we maybe could. But we've got some new road wheels from Fulcrum, don't we?
Yeah. I've been willy all over my wheels today. Sorry about that. Really need to apologize for that. It's late at night here. But yes, Fulcrum do have a new set of what they're calling more versatile and more affordable wheel sets that are pretty much based on the Speed 42 and Speed 57s that we've seen released earlier this year. In fact, these new wheels, they're calling the Wind 42 and Wind 57. And as the name sort of suggests, they have pretty much the exact same rim profile as those more expensive speed performance focused wheels. But these are obviously replacing the existing Wind range, and the new rims are taller and wider, with a new 23 millimeter internal rim and 29 millimeter external. They're carbon, of course, and they're hooked tubeless compatible. And they also feature that sort of sealed rim that we, you know, come to expect from Fulcrum and Campag also. So tubeless compatible without like rim tape. But despite being taller and wider, Fulcrum are saying that these wheels are actually lighter than the old Wind wheel set. So they're saying that's thanks to a new sort of mix of carbon and new carbon layups. But yeah, sort of I was going to say relatively affordable. I probably can't go that far. You're looking at £1,250, $1,600, €1,400 for a wheel set that's basically the same as the Speed wheel set that's €800 more expensive. The only real difference, again, being that carbon layup, it's a FF80 mix that Fulcrum calls it in the new wheels versus the FF100 in the Speeds. And basically the difference is there that they're a little bit heavier, but aerodynamically they should perform pretty similar.
The standout there was the 23 millimeter internal width, because Fulcrum's been historically very traditional, as you know, along with Campag in that sense. But yeah, 23 is wider than I thought they would have gone.
Yeah. I mean, it's the 29 that jumps out to me, the external width being a bit of an arrow weenie or whatever, should work well with the 28 mil tire there, aerodynamically speaking. One other difference, sorry, the Winds also use a sealed cartridge bearing in the hubs rather than cup and cone that you get in the
There's probably some weight savings there as well in that hub compared to cup and cone system, but whether that's intentional or whether it's just a cost thing, but yeah, I'd imagine.
Wind 42s are basically 1,500 grams, whereas the 57s are about 1,585 grams claimed weight.
Bad.
Not bad for a 57 mil rim.
Yeah, I mean, Fulcrum and, you know, Campagnolo, which they won't like me saying this, but they're typically a very, very similar wheel, except for generally the lacing pattern and the logos. But yeah, they're historically a very reliable option, and you know, if you can get a wheel that's competitive in weight from them, then chances are you're going to have a great experience.
Yeah, and reliable in terms of hub quality in particular. Like their bearings have always been really good, and the build quality has generally been very good. So historically for me, it has been one of those brands where they don't always kind of like jump off the page on paper in terms of their specs. Oftentimes it's one of those things where the qualities, where their positive qualities sometimes don't really come out until, you know, several years down the road.
Yep. An underrated product, which is saying something because they're actually quite popular. So it's,
The other, not sure if I mentioned this starting up, but I meant to, but the other big difference between these and the speeds that, that these are actually rated for or approved for light gravel use or ASTM category two.
Yeah.
If you know what that means.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's in relation to like the testing done on the wheels and the rider system weight. So it's like the, if you see like a 90 kilogram max limit on a set of wheels, it typically means that they're specifically for road use. And then the 110 kilogram system use typically means they've passed the standards for use on light off-road use. So that's sort of where that comes from. That's worth a deep dive. We should flag that and come back to that topic at some point.
Scribble on that down, Dave.
120 kilo limit on the new 57s.
Yeah. There you go. So, yeah, I might be confusing standards there a little bit, but yeah, we'll come back to that.
Yeah, I think, well, Fulcrum at least are referring to this one in terms of it's, these wheels are approved for light gravel off-road use. So take them any further than that, you're likely to not do them any favors, but they're certainly, you know, one of the things they're marketing as a difference between these and the speeds is the options that offers you in terms of going off the tarmac.
All right. Well, anyway, I suppose maybe we can look into bringing a couple of these sets of wheels in for review if we think about it. But let's move on to tires in the next little bit of news here, because we got a couple little interesting developments. So I feel like it's been kind of forever and a day that various people have been trying to come up with an airless bicycle tire that doesn't actually suck. And one of the most intriguing entrants is actually made out of metal, of all things. So more specifically, it's a nickel titanium alloy called Nitinol that this new brand called the Smart Tire Company. It says it's a, quote, lightweight, highly flexible, super elastic metal that stretches like rubber but is strong like titanium and will always instantly snap back into its original shape, unquote. Looking at the tire itself, it kind of looks like sort of like a big slinky toy that's kind of fashioned into a hoop and then covered with a traditional tread.
Fancy garden hose.
Kind of, yeah. So, like, it is covered. The metal is covered all the way around. So some pretty intriguing qualities. So the company is saying that it can be retreaded for just $10, like starting at $10. So meaning you can theoretically use the same casing over and over again, which is good for sustainability, of course. And then the claimed weight is actually surprisingly reasonable at 450 grams for a 700 by 32 size. I mean, if any of this sounds kind of familiar, that's because it was actually previously pitched not too long ago under the Metal moniker, Metal as in M-E-T-L. From a few years ago. So, but now the big difference is that it's supposedly ready for prime time, if you consider prime time being Kickstarter campaign. And a pair of tires is selling for, it looks like everyone's sitting down. A pair of tires is selling for $500. I would imagine we have some thoughts on this. Who wants to chime in first?
My first thought is air is free. To inflate your tires with, and that's like the main pitch here, right? Is that you?
For
airless tire, yeah. For the meantime, yeah. Anyway, it's. I think that's worth noting. I also think historically, any airless tire has always fallen apart in the actual usability of it, in terms of getting it on the rim easily, taking it off the rim if you ever need to do it, and then bigger picture, what does the tread look like? What, you know, how does that perform? Does it actually grip? I think it's a very interesting engineering problem to solve. And, you know, the company has contracts with the likes of NASA and all that. I truly do believe it's a very interesting segment, but I think it's one of those engineering problems that is probably harder than it needs to be given pneumatic tires are so good.
Do you get the feeling it's one of those engineering problems that the engineers have looked at the bicycle and thought that would be a good place to start, rather than maybe looking at somewhere that might be a better place to start.
Wouldn't be the first time. Can someone say, did I hear someone say Superstrata?
Yeah, I think
bicycles, they're easy.
I think they've even gone on record to say that they're starting with a Kickstarter bicycle product as like a way to prove the product in a consumer marketplace. You know, rather than starting in cars or something like that.
All right. Well, like I said, I mean, this whole metal tire thing or the airless tire thing, it's something that people seem compelled to continue to chase, and we'll see how this one goes. $500 a pair, though, sounds like it's basically just going to be a little bit of a science experiment, but we'll see.
Yeah.
It'll be fun to follow.
It's promising, I think.
Yeah.
Given the company behind it and the history that they've had in getting here, I think it's probably one of the more promising options.
It's going to be interesting to follow regardless. Yeah. So in not so good tire news, however, we've got a recall to share. So this time it comes from Pirelli. Specifically, the recall applies to the P0 Race TLR, those road tires in the 700x28mm size. The official notice suggests there's about 14,500 affected tires floating about. Although the notice supposedly only affects tires sold through competitive cyclist Trek and Angry Catfish stores between March 2023 through July 2023. And there's also date codes listed between 1023 and 2423. The recall notice does not go into like real nitty gritty specifics as far as what exactly is wrong with these tires, but it does say that there's a risk of, quote, rapid air loss, unquote. So take that as you will. So as always with any recall, if you think you might have some of these things, the first thing you need to do is to stop riding them and then contact your place of purchase for more info. But you should keep in mind that even if you didn't buy those tires at one of those three retailers mentioned, it's unclear if Trek may have been the distributor for wherever you did buy them. So best thing to do is just go ahead and head over to Pirelli.com for more info on that and play it safe. Because I would say that a sudden tire blow off does not sound fun.
It says with certain rims, is something I saw mentioned. Rapid air loss with certain rims. Do we think those certain rims
might be hookless?
Might be hookless.
You know, it's unfortunately just vague. Yeah. I mean, that's always kind of the thing with these recall notices. Like they're meant for the general public. They often don't contain anywhere near as much technical information as we would want. Mm. And realistically, they probably only include just as much technical information as the manufacturer is willing to disclose. Yeah. So don't know. And we don't know if this is we don't know if it's a hookless thing. We don't know if it's like a sudden casing failure, if the bead itself is going to break, if the tire is going to blow. We don't really know. Just don't really have a whole lot of info. But yeah, the point being, if you have some of those tires, stop riding them. And like if you have been riding them and you're thinking to yourself, oh, these have been fine, I'll just keep riding them. The problem with those sorts of things is they're often fine until they're not. So some of you listening may have maybe thinking to yourself that this is not a new recall. It's like, huh, I think I've heard this before. That's because Pirelli did announce this recall earlier in different regions. So this is a notice that just went out to North America not too long ago. Same tires, same date codes, from what I understand anyway, but the difference here is that each country does have its own governing body for this sort of thing. So that's why notices are kind of going out somewhat haphazardly, but either way, the tire is the same, the advice is the same, and our advice is certainly the same.
They just needed to establish that the American air was causing the same issues as the British
yes,
air.
Yes.
And yes. Yes, we got there.
All right, anyway, enough with tires. We're going to head back to the e-bike beat just for a bit. So it's very, very likely you have heard about this brand Rad Power. You've probably seen a whole bunch of them rolling around wherever you are. We've certainly talked about them here in the past, and Rad Power has made an interesting announcement the other day saying that given all the attention in recent months on e-bike battery fires, moving forward, they're committing to only producing bikes that comply with UL safety standards. So the company CEO, Phil Molyneux, sorry, I'm, my apologies, Phil, if I'm butchering your name, recently said in an interview with the tech publication The Verge, quote, "We're very passionate about safety of our riders and the quality of our bikes and pushing the industry forward. And that's coming from the mantle that we are America's largest e-bike brand. And so we have a responsibility to drive the e-bike momentum forward in terms of the safety agenda," unquote. So just to provide a little bit of background, UL is maybe better known by its old name, Underwriters Laboratories. It's a U.S.-based but global nonprofit organization. It basically just sort of determines if a whole bunch of different consumer products are safe to use. I think it's great that Rad Power is making this pledge, and I think it's good that it's going to happen as soon as model year 24 stuff. So it's going to be rolling out pretty soon. However, Rad Power has been selling an awful lot of bikes, and that also means that the company has been knowingly putting out over 600,000 of these e-bikes out into the world that were not UL listed, and that was by their own choice.
Yep. I kind of see there being quite a lot of PR spin in this one, in that they are probably in the near future going to be forced to offer something of UL standards or equivalent in order to sell their bikes within certain regions of the US. Like New York are pushing for this. I know there are other states in the US that are quickly moving to bring in required standards in this level. And I think, yeah, Rad Power to exist as a company moving forward would have had to have done this anyway. So I kind of see this as a bit of spin. I think they needed to do it. I agree, James. It's a bit worrying that it's taken them this long. And I think it's also worth noting that any brand that isn't meeting these standards or an equivalent safety standard, you probably shouldn't buy, I think is probably the main thing to say. Like, you know, all the high-end e-bikes that in the market, Bosch, Shimano, Brose, whatever high-end brand, they all pass these standards. It's just the lower cost stuff that I think is really worth looking at and scrutinizing before you ever purchase one.
And the doubly frustrating thing about it is that for the brands who aren't up to these standards, and for the likes of Rad Power moving to these standards, it might already be too late for a heck of a lot of people who want something as awesome as an e-bike, because I know there's like apartment blocks, and you know, you spoke about New York City and all there, where bans may well be implemented, and if the person implementing those bans are not cyclists or fans of e-bikes, it may be very difficult to get those bans overturned.
The damage is absolutely done.
Much worse than that is obviously when there's a fire that happens as a result of one of these, and you know, whole buildings at risk, people with inside it are at risk. It's kind of, these shooting themselves in the foot, and that just as e-bikes are taking off, you're getting all this bad press because they're just not up to, or a few brands are not up to standards that the others are.
Yeah, and I don't want to come off as being anti-e-bike at all. I mean, I actually really like e-bikes. I obviously own one. I've talked about our Urban Aero quite a bit. Dave, you just bought an e-bike. You know, Wade has a second one. You know, Wade has a specialized Levo that he commutes on quite a bit. I'm very pro e-bike in general. I'm very anti low quality, sketchy, sort of, you know, sketchy manufacturing e-bike. Let's just make that very clear. So I certainly know of a whole bunch of shops who actually won't work on e-bikes that don't use UL certified components. And you know, for obvious reasons, we were just talking about the whole battery fire thing. I'm not saying that a bike that is not UL certified is going to catch on fire or anything, but there is that extra layer of confidence that you know, someone has dotted their I's and crossed their T's and stuff when you're looking at these things.
Yeah. Like using Bosch as an example, their battery technology is pretty impressive when you look at all the safety measures that are within that battery and all the redundancies and the way that they can prevent thermal runaway and all that. So you look at a battery off an AliExpress e-bike, for example, and it doesn't have really any of those safety measures. So there's absolutely cause for concern here. And as Ronan was saying, unfortunately, having so many e-bikes in the market that don't meet these standards has done the damage. And hopefully it's not too late for the e-bike market and the, you know, electric vehicle market to rewind some of that damage and prove that these products can be safe to own.
All right. Well, kind of continuing on with the questionable e-bike quality sort of thing. We've got another recall, this time from this another company called Lectric. So E-L-E-C-T-R-I-C. And this particular recall has nothing to do with e-bike components at all, but rather the mechanical disc brakes that that brand uses. So according to the, this again, so this is a U.S. recall. So according to the CPSC recall notice, quote, the mechanical disc brake calipers located on the front and rear of the e-bike can fail, resulting in loss of control, posing crash and injury hazards to the driver, unquote. That recall notice also says that there's about 45,000 of these e-bikes out in the world, so not nearly as many as the Red Powers. But CPSC says its report, CPSC says it's received reports of four reports of a loss of braking power, quote, loss of braking power, including two injuries that involved cuts, scrapes, and a broken bone, unquote. Of course, the notice says that you should stop riding these things right away. And the company apparently is reaching out to owners directly to supply replacement front and rear mechanical disc brake calipers. And they're also supplying up to $100 toward the cost of replacing those. So kind of going along the lines of what you were saying earlier, Daley, I don't see this as a failing of the e-bike industry specifically, but it's most definitely a failing of, you know, super cheap and crappy e-bikes in general, because these e-bike components do cost money to add to a regular bike. And then particularly when you have the inexpensive e-bike market kind of selling themselves based on power and range, but seemingly mostly on power and max speed, that sort of thing. These things are class three, meaning that they have throttle control. They have assist up to 28 miles per hour, which is, what is that? Is that 45K, I think? Relatively low cost of entry. They're super popular with kids in particular. I mean, it's bad enough that we have a bunch of crappy bikes out there, period. But crappy e-bikes in particular just come across to me as absolute disasters waiting to happen.
Yeah, it feels to me like brakes are often, far too often, an area of cost cutting. I mean, they have to cut costs on everything on these bikes in order to hit the price point. So, but I think brakes are the one that continuously come up as the problem. And I mean, to me that, yeah, I mean, it makes sense that that's the case, because brakes are one of the only safety related things that you're gonna see become a problem. I don't know. It's, for me, like a bike like this, there's so much more weight in it. It's going faster. You need better brakes on a bike like this than you do on an analog bike.
Especially when you've got four kids on it.
And at this price point, we're still seeing analog bikes with brakes that aren't good enough. So it just makes sense that, to me, I'm not surprised at all by this recall. Like, I think it's just bound to happen with the number of bikes in the market with brakes that just aren't suitable for what they need to do. I mean, you and I, James, we tested some road bikes last year that had mechanical disc brakes that should have been fine. They just were not safe. Like, we bed them in and we just couldn't come to a stop in what we deemed to be a safe distance. And that's a racing bike of a decent quality level. We're talking about e-bikes here, which are much heavier and still trying to hit the same price point.
If anyone listening to this podcast is an actuary, I would love to see some numbers crunched as far as what the potential cost savings are for these companies that are looking to spec such cheap, low quality components on their bike versus the potential cost of a lawsuit that would happen when someone invariably gets hurt on these things. I would have to imagine there's some tipping point there, and yeah, maybe they're calculating this ahead of time. Maybe they're being that callous about it, and maybe they're not. I'm not really sure. If this thing affects 45,000 e-bikes, if, you know, they're saving, I don't know, a couple bucks on each one, which is maybe not outside of the realm of possibility. You know, let's say they're saving $100,000, $200,000 in production cost. But if they get hit with one decent lawsuit, you know, in the United States, we like to sue people. So if you're going to sue someone, you're going to sue for a lot of money. So you say, let's just say you get one lawsuit that you have to settle or whatever for, you know, $1 million, $2 million, $5 million, whatever. Then all of a sudden that money that you saved nickel and diming the bike, like, you just flushed it all down the toilet.
Yeah. I will say, like, mechanical disc brakes aren't the problem here, but like bad mechanical disc brakes are the problem. The other big issue here is that these bikes, mechanical disc brakes especially, require ongoing maintenance to actually work well. And I can tell you that of the 45,000 bikes that were recalled, I would assume 40,000 of them would probably only see a mechanic when the brakes go bad, when the brakes stop working. they'd be taken in for a service. It'd be a very reactive service.
I feel like you're being very generous.
Maybe
with that
very
number,
generous.
Dave.
Maybe 49,000 and something. But yeah, I think that again is fundamental here. Is that the e-bike brands are not doing enough to educate customers on the needs to regularly service these things and to ensure that the brakes are consistently in working order. Because I would suspect that some of these, you know, some of those reported injuries probably could have been prevented with having a mechanic go over the bike.
Yeah, and we were just talking about Rad Power a few minutes ago. They had a recall not that long ago related to rim strips. So if there are any mechanics out there, Rad Power, apparently they were using just like the super, super cheap butyl rim strips in their rims for quite a while. And not surprisingly, there were a bunch of wheels where that strip would migrate over and expose the spoke nipple heads. And then they were having blowouts of the tubes. And then, you know, you have these cargo bikes, which are already heavier to begin with, and then they may or may not have been loaded down with people or groceries or whatever. And then at that point, when you have a blowout, it's not going to be good. So however many pennies Rad Power saved on that decision, I'm positive that did not work out.
Yeah, they should spend $500 on airless tires.
more worrying news on a similar topic there, but I think it was Kristen Jenny at Cycling Weekly was reporting today or yesterday that actually Rad Power facing another class action lawsuit for allegedly faulty forks and quick release skewer designs, which again, when factored in with the weight of these bikes, was causing a serious injury. I think the person taking the suit actually broke 5 ribs in a crash, and he's taking a case, so obviously he is laying the blame with Rad Power there.
I think I mentioned something at least a year ago on the podcast, something along the lines of that I don't believe e-bikes should be at such a low cost price point, and that I kind of think, you know, if you're going to buy an e-bike, you should only buy one from a reputable brand, and that there's kind of like a price minimum to this, and I feel kind of justified right now because, yeah, there's no way to make a bike that cheap and have everything perfect.
But that's kind of double the problem here, is that if you want one of the e-bikes that you or I would want,
yeah,
they cost a lot of money.
It's a huge amount of money, but at least it's safe.
Yeah. And we probably wouldn't go for one of these cheaper bikes that we have question marks about. But if you're, you know, if you're not a cyclist or you're not all that into, you know, everything we've just discussed here, you might look at one of these cheaper options and go, well, it's an e-bike, that's what I want, and it's far better value for money. What could go wrong?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, sometimes a lot can go wrong. So it's probably the customers who are most at risk here are also the customers who are least likely to be aware of the risks.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Yeah, and again, like, I am certainly not anti-e-bike in any way, but, you know, if you talk to people who work in hospitals and emergency room staff and that sort of thing, it is not just anecdotal information. Like, there is definitely statistical evidence out there that a lot more people are getting hurt on these things, oftentimes because, you know, they have brakes that don't work or they have too many people on them, whatever. But the sorts of injuries that we're seeing on these bikes are often now not so much injuries that you often see with bicycles, but they're like injuries that you more often see with like mopeds and motorcycles, yeah, that sort of thing. So yeah, these things often have quite a lot of power. They go quite fast. And yeah, when you go real fast and you don't have brakes that don't work, that's a problem.
And they're often being used by people with no experience.
I was going to say, I kind of worry about the rhetoric around that, but I really worry about it because I'm not saying that doesn't happen, that people don't get injured on e-bikes, but you know, people get injured in cars and mopeds and electric scooters, James, we get injured in multiple different ways, but for some reason there seems to be a focus on e-bike injuries, or at least maybe I'm just more aware of it because, you know, I want an e-bike and I don't have an e-bike, and I see this pop up and I worry then, or, you know, and someone was going to mention earlier and it didn't because it kind of takes us off topic, but the last time I had a run on an e-bike, I think, or a proper prolonged run on an e-bike, was back in like 2017, 2018, when I worked with Sustrans. And being a charity that promotes walking and cycling, we had just invested in a fleet of new e-bikes, only to discover after buying this fleet that at that time, under Northern Irish legislation, e-bikes had to be taxed and insured like motorbikes. And with no functioning government, as is often the case here, there was no way to get that legislation updated. And so the bikes were out of action unless one scrupulous employee snuck down during lunchtime and took them out to go and get his lunch.
Which, of course, never happened.
Never happened. But yeah, my fear is that we just, you know, Paris has banned scooters. Are they going to ban e-bikes? You know, a lot of the town bikes you see there are e-bikes. You only have to walk through a city with a bike share scheme to see that the state of disrepair that these bikes are in. And if the accidents that are happening on those bikes are lumped in, and the response to those accidents are lumped in with just all e-bikes, generally speaking, I think that could be quite worrying.
Well, it's kind of as is the case with many things, right? Like the thing sounds good in theory, but the execution is often lacking. And to me, I feel like with a lot of the e-bike things, I think it's fantastic that people are using e-bikes to get around, the whole micromobility movement, not having to get into cars and that sort of thing. Those are all huge positives. However, I also see lots of pitfalls with offering bikes that make it so easy for people to go that fast and to carry that many people without any sort of education or without any sort of limitations and that sort of thing. I mean, yes, there is legislation in a lot of cases, but I mean, who are we kidding? Who hasn't seen a kid with, like, you know, towing two of their buddies on one of these things just ripping through a neighborhood somewhere? It sounds great in theory, but it just sounds like the execution is a recipe for problems.
There was a kid where I used to live who had just gone like a whole step further and added a motor to his mountain bike. No pedaling required at that point. It was just open the throttle, and you could hear him coming for about 5 minutes before he actually reached this point.
Excellent. Oh, I sound like such a grumpy old man. Anyway, all right, let's get on to some fun news here to round out our new segment here. So you may have heard of American pro cyclist Ashton Lambie. He first earned a name for himself on the track. He's kind of more recently started doing a bunch of gravel racing, though, and had a little bit of a mishap while out on course at an event in Spain. So according to his Instagram post, he, quote, unclipped and somehow put his foot through the seat stay while trying to keep it upright, unquote. The result of that foot through his seat stay was a totally broken seat stay on his Lauf Sigla, which he apparently repaired with a stick and baling twine that he found on the side of the road. So he could keep going. Repaired. And this was just before. So this happened very early on in the race too. So, and this was just to kind of get him by until he could do what he called a sturdier fix with tape and zip ties at the next aid station. So, like I said, this happened very early in the event, and he still managed to finish. This event was 110 miles long, so I'm not sure what that is in kilometers, and 9,000 feet of climbing, so, you know, almost 3,000 meters or so. The pictures are absolutely bonkers. You need to go check out his Instagram page. His tag is Bahama Longbottom on Instagram, so just go ahead and check it out. You've got to see the pictures. It's fantastic.
I've seen this being done before. Camp utensils like titanium forks, spokes, and zip ties are absolutely the primo way to do this if you happen to be traveling overnight and have the ability to do that. But yeah, this is it's amazing what you can use to fix a seat stay and actually have it survive.
So one product that someone mentioned to me, sorry, I can't remember their name, but. Dave, you might remember this thing. It was called FiberFix. It was basically this pouch that had essentially like a water activated, some sort of like epoxy fabric wrap. It almost looked like an ACE bandage, like if you sprain your wrist or ankle or something like that. But it was already preloaded with a bunch of epoxy. And so that company was bought by JB Weld. It's now called JB Weld Fiber Weld. That actually seems like it would have been a perfect, like absolutely perfect product for Ashton Lambie to have with him on this event.
Maybe a new sponsor.
It's maybe. It seems like a prime opportunity. But I did check. Speaking of prime, it's actually on sale for $9 on Amazon at the moment. I checked. Okay.
I don't know what you're talking about there, James, but Jack Aiken, who's a member of Escape Collective. Yes, that Jack Aiken. That's a real niche joke. Some people might get it, most won't. But he was messaging me recently telling me about these large sheets of quickset carbon fiber that they, with like sort of an adhesive back on it that they use. So he's, I should say, Jack Aiken's like an endurance car driver, has driven in Formula One. And he was saying in their endurance races at the moment, or not at the moment, but just in general, if they have like a crash or damage the car, they can quickly apply this quickset carbon fiber. It will, I don't think it really gives it much structural rigidity, but it just stops the thing from falling apart mid-race. So I don't know if that's similar or not, but something like that. Although I think this frame from Ashton's is just... I did notice he did something else today, like a further repair that wasn't really just like taking a stick of carbon fiber and taped it to the chains, the seat stay.
I would love for him to just sort of like continue with bodge after bodge and just keep racing this thing and just see how far into the season he can get.
No, seat stays are surplus. I wouldn't put it past him for doing that either. He's, yeah, I don't know. It's on brand.
It's pretty awesome.
For those who maybe don't know, but Ashton's also like the first person in history to go sub 4 minutes for an individual 4K pursuit.
Yeah. Yeah. He's wicked fast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Minor correction. I mean, James, you mentioned he was a track cyclist that more recently has done gravel, but I actually think it's the other way around. I think he was.
Oh, was it?
I think he was an ultra endurance gravel cyclist who realized he had massive power and then tried his hand at track.
I think you're right, Dave. Yeah. I think you're right.
Now he obviously just smashes both. So, yeah. Anyway, I think he might be listening. So, hello.
Well, Ashton, if you are listening, if you do take my suggestion to heart, I can't wait to follow that on Instagram. It's so good. Anyway, all right. That wraps it up for the news segment of the show. As I said earlier or early on, I had quite a lot of news to get through this week's episode. So we're running kind of long here. Anyone here have anything on their mind this week?
Yeah, I've got $10,000 wheels on my mind because I just wrapped up a review of the Partington MK2 R39-44 wheels, which are an Australian made full carbon wheel, which had the intentions when they launched to kind of become the new lightweight of the industry, like the, you know, disc brake specific tubeless ready wheel that was lighter than lightweight, had similar stiffness and I guess ride attributes, but just with a new fresh approach to how they built the wheel. I've wrapped up my test of that wheel and I have to say it's probably the best road wheel set I've ever used. And that kind of pains.
They'd better be, Dave.
And that pains me because I've given them back and I now like my bike a whole lot less.
Oh my. I mean, Dave, I think you and I talked about those Partingtons when I did that Synchros wheel review. Because certainly as jaw-dropping as that $10,000 price tag, and that's Australian, isn't it?
Yeah, it's in the six range for US. Yeah.
So as much as that price tag definitely makes my eyes water a little bit, it's actually become a pretty competitive price point at this point in terms of like what else is out there.
It's cheaper than lightweights, Obermeyer lightweights. So yeah, they're not the most expensive wheel, which is saying is ridiculous to say, but it's true. But yeah, I mean those Syncross are a bit lower cost, aren't they?
They were lower cost. They were wider. They were lighter. They were presumably not more lighter. Aero and so on and so forth. They were not. Oh well, the Partingtons were shallower though, weren't they?
No.
Dave, we had this discussion. There was something.
The Partingtons are shallower than the one you tested, but not then compared to the SL Syncross, the lightweight Syncross, which are still a few grams heavier than the Partington. And then it gets ridiculous is that Partington are currently working on an even shallower version, which will be about 100 grams lighter again.
Will those even stay upright?
I don't know. I mean, having just ridden these, I'm going to say yes. They're very impressive, and I think the price reflects that. But yeah, I was blown away by how a wheel can be so stiff yet still somewhat compliant. And I think you had similar things to say about the Syncross.
For sure, for sure. I mean, for as much as we kind of lambast ultra expensive wheels like that, the sad fact of the matter is that they are stupidly good. And Ronan, as you're going to find out not too long from now, because I just put you in touch with someone from Lightweight because they want to send over a set of Lonan wheels for us to review. So yeah, unfortunately, we're going to be perpetuating this whole thing of really, really expensive wheels.
We're
somehow
all going to be disappointed with our bikes. Soon.
Yeah, we're not really going to be necessarily saying that you have to have these things, but the sad fact of the matter is oftentimes those crazy expensive wheels are actually better, even if they're not proportionally better, they are often better.
But not in every situation. So I mean, as my review points out, I mean, there are limitations to having such a stiff wheel, and for me it was when I was riding less than ideal surface tarmac stuff, you know, say tarmac that's probably been put over really rooty terrain, so you can actually feel the roots through the tarmac. And if you're cornering on that, then such a high lateral stiffness doesn't lend itself to having as much traction as when you do that same corner on a more flexible wheel.
That and they don't make you your morning coffee or make your bed or wash your clothes for you and so on and so forth.
They do not. So limitations, but yeah, I mean, there's absolutely trade-offs to having such a single piece wheel, but for the most part, I was very blown away by how good they did so many things.
Gotcha. All right. Well, I'll be eagerly awaiting the next iteration of these Partington wheels.
Single piece wheel followed by a single figure bank account. Balance.
Yeah. Ronan, based on previous conversations, I know you've got quite a lot on your mind that you've been building up for the last few weeks, and I've got something for this week as well. But we're running pretty long here, so I'm just going to go ahead and cut it off for the on your mind segment here, and we're just going to wrap up with a single PSA. So I can't remember which Escape Collective member sent me this little info, but we do have a little interesting word of caution for some Shimano DIT owners out there. Maybe not so much word of caution, but anyway, if you look carefully at the Shimano manual for the DI2 charger, there's a specific mention regarding the DI2 charger input wattage. So this is a direct quote. It says, quote, use an AC adapter with a USB port that has a voltage of 5.0 volts DC and a current higher than 1 amp DC. If one with a current lower than 1 amp is used, the AC adapter may heat up, potentially causing a fire, smoke, overheating, electric shock, or burns, unquote.
Just full of fires tonight.
Yeah, well, this was intriguing because you kind of intuitively would think that if you use a charger that kicked out way too much power, that would be a problem. So it didn't really come across as particularly obvious that if you use a charger that didn't put out enough power, that would be an issue. But it kind of reached out to someone. So this is not an official comment from Shimano. We weren't really able to get a statement from them on this. But from what I understand, the way it was explained to me was that as long as the correct voltage adapter is used, so the device is only going to draw as much amperage as it needs. So you can never get too many amps. However, if the adapter's rated current is lower than what the device wants for an input, then it's possible that device could power and draw more current than it was really designed for. So that could cause the adapter to overheat or fail. That's why that's going on there. Like, basically, it's trying to draw more power than it's rated for.
What I want to know is, do I still need to use a laptop to charge my DI2? I don't have a DI2, but if I did.
I guess that depends on the output of your USB ports, huh?
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah. One of the rules I was told with DI2 is not to plug into like one of the straight generic USB power outlets like in a wall, and is to always go through like a voltage controlled device like a laptop, but also you could probably, you know, quite safely use a USB PowerPoint adapter that is, you know, of known quality from a reputable phone manufacturer or something similar.
Well, I mean, the reason why this comes up, though, is because a lot of older phone chargers don't actually put out enough power. And I think those are specifically the ones where you could run into an issue. Because some of the older, especially tiny phone chargers, some of those just might not put out enough power. So, yeah, that's just my friendly PSA. So, as I mentioned before,
just created panic.
Yeah. So anyway, check the ratings on the back of the power adapter that you're using for your DI2. If you're somehow able to read that just ridiculously small font that they stick on those things, it's got to be what, like, I don't know, like 0.2 point font or something like that. I don't know, it's just ridiculous. And it somehow always ends up being like light silver on white or something mm-hmm. like that. Anyway, I did mention that little tip came to us from an Escape Collective member. Speaking of members, so Dave, how do we pay for all this stuff? How does Geek Warning get funded?
I sell my personal tool collection, and
so we're good for years.
Yeah. No, we're entirely member funded, so it's through our subscribers and our readers that this content is brought to everyone and continues to be brought to everyone, and it's how we create all of our content. So yeah, if you're listening, then hopefully you're already a member or a paid reader, and if not, then seriously, please consider it. I mean, we are about to do a special episode, which you'll hear, but yeah, we're moving to have more podcasts, and those podcasts will be made exclusive to our members, so we'll tell you more about that soon, but yeah, you'll be missing out if you're not a member soon enough.
So if you haven't already hit stop on your computer or phone or whatever at this point, one thing we do absolutely request, if you're not going to become a member of the Escape Collective, which would make us very, very sad, by the way, please at least head over to iTunes and leave us a rating and review, because that also helps us out, because it helps more people find Geek Warning. So yeah, at least do us that favor if you're not going to become a member. So that's all we ask.
We make a deal.
Oh, a deal. What you got?
Members can leave whatever rating they feel is adequate. Non-members have to do 5-star ratings.
I don't know. I feel like a lot of our members will find the humor in giving us 1-star reviews without realizing how much that'll actually impact our discoverability.
Okay, no deal. Yeah, no deal. I take that back.
Yeah.
5-stars only.
Yeah.
Say what you want in the comments, but 5-stars only.
Yes, there you go. That's a good compromise.
We'll leave it at that. Say whatever you want in the comments, but 5-stars only. That sounds like a very, very good, very, very good pitch. All right, that's all we've got for this week's Geek Warning. Thanks as always for listening. We'll see you next week.
Cheers.